Imagine your hometown is suddenly taken over by an armed faction.
Right, a total occupation.
Yeah, exactly. But before they blow up the bridges or, before they cut the power or seize the banks, they actually do something far more insidious. They quietly erase your history.
It is the ultimate strategic maneuver. Because, you don't just conquer a territory physically, you really have to conquer its memory.
You do. Welcome to the deep dive. We're looking at a staggering reality today. When a region is torn apart by, decades of social fracture and conflict, the very first casualty is almost always invisible.
It's the loss of the everyday narratives, the stories that give a community its actual identity.
Exactly. But today, we are going to look at the people who fight back. We have this massive stack of sources on the table today: biographical files, decades of journalistic chronicles, poetry collections, and a really dense, fascinating visual art catalog.
And what makes this entire collection so compelling is the geographic anchor. We are zeroing in on two creators from the exact same region in Colombia,
The Valle
Del
de...
Cauca.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our mission today is to explore how a journalist and poet named Manuel Tiberio Bermudez and a visual artist named Jairo Duque used entirely different mediums to weave the exact same net of
A
resistance.
resistance against cultural amnesia, really.
Right. And we are going to trace a wild trajectory here. We're starting in the literal dirt-like, the hyper-local roots of a specific province, and we are going to see how that foundation unexpectedly transforms into this universal defensive piece.
Yeah, and if that isn't enough, we're going to follow these two very analog creators as they make this dizzying leap into our current AI-driven digital age.
It's quite a ride. To understand how their message eventually reached a global scale, you first really have to examine the soil they grew in, right?
Absolutely. The hyperlocal isn't just a starting point here, it's basically the engine for everything that follows.
So let's start with that foundation. Manuel Tiberio Bermudez, he was born in 1949 in a town called Caicedonia, and his early career is just defined by this massive boots-on-the-ground immersion in local traditional media.
We are talking about traditional media powerhouses in Colombia. I mean, he was a broadcaster for the RCN network in Buenaventura, a correspondent for Todeler in Quindío.
And he directed shows on Radio Super, right?
Yeah, and pay attention to the names of his radio shows. They kind of reveal his entire philosophy.
They really do. Voces y ecos, so voices and echoes and linea directa, direct line. To me, this type of local journalism, it functions almost like the nervous system of a region.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. Think about the contrast here. A macroeconomist sitting in some glass tower in the capital is just reading a spreadsheet. They see, I don't know, a 2% dip in agricultural output and categorize it as like a mild
A
recession.
blip on the radar.
Exactly. But the local regional journalists, they are the actual nerve endings. They feel the strikes, the failed harvests, the desperation of the farmers, and even the joy of the town festivals directly on their skin.
They aren't gathering statistics. They're gathering the raw daily data of the human condition.
Yeah. And that tactile, everyday reality is explicitly documented in his written record as well. The sources highlight his columns for newspapers like El Pueblo, El País, and later on, digital portals like Las Teorías.
What's interesting is he completely bypasses highbrow political theory in these pieces. Instead, he leans into highly colloquial, everyday reflections.
Yeah, he used column titles like Ave Maria or Haika de Semerara Kali, which means like, we have to untie Kali.
It's very grounded language, and all of this culminates in a book of chronicles that carries what might be the ultimate provincial declaration for a title.
Oh, yeah. The book is called Gracias a Dios Soy Montañero.
Thank God I'm a Montañero.
Essentially, thank God I'm a hillbilly, a mountain dweller, a man of the provinces. It is a massive point of pride for him. But wait, I actually have to challenge this strategy for a second.
Okay, go for it.
If your ultimate goal as a writer is to address massive, complex national issues, like an armed conflict that has killed tens of thousands, or the monumental task of peace and reconciliation, doesn't proudly branding yourself a Montañero completely alienate a reader in New York or Paris?
You'd think so, right?
Yeah. I mean, how does he expect to reach a global audience by putting up a giant sign that basically says, I am highly provincial? Doesn't that limit him?
What's fascinating here is that the mechanics of sociology and literature actually work in the exact opposite direction.
Wait, really? How so?
Deep immersion in local reality is actually the only true laboratory for universal empathy.
Okay, but how does that actually work in practice?
Well, Bermudez doesn't speak of peace as an abstract academic theory.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about it because he literally has the names, the surnames, and the faces of the victims written down in his reporter's notebook.
Oh, I see. It's not a hypothetical for him.
Exactly. That grassroots authenticity, the fact that he knows the smell of the local market, the texture of the dirt roads, and the exact tone of a mother's grief in his specific town, is what gives him moral authority.
So when he speaks to the world, he is grounded in unquestionable reality. He isn't lecturing from a think tank.
No, he's reporting from the emotional front lines.
The credibility is earned through proximity to the pain. That makes total sense. And that proximity forces a shift, because eventually, just chronicling the daily grind wasn't enough for Bermudez.
Right. The sources show him moving from observing reality to actively trying to change it.
Yeah. He steps into active advocacy. Mm. He takes on the role of press head for the National and International Encounter of Writers for Peace.
Steering their communications through several editions in the early 2000s, yeah.
And later, he leads communications for an initiative called Art Without Borders for Peace. But here's the shocking pivot in his timeline. We have this rugged, boots-on-the-ground, proudly Montanero journalist who has spent decades reporting hard news, right? And then in 2017, he publishes a book of poetry
titled New York No Es El Cielo, New York Is Not Heaven.
And suddenly, this local journalist from Caicedonia is being invited to the International Book Fair in Cuba, poetry festivals in El Salvador, and cultural events in New York.
It's a huge leap.
It is. Why the pivot? I mean, why switch from the undeniable facts of journalism to poetry when you were dealing with something as brutal and physical as social conflict?
It comes down to understanding how the human brain processes information, especially regarding trauma. Journalism feeds the brain the cold metrics of tragedy.
The casualty counts, the dates, the locations.
Exactly. The prefrontal cortex receives that data and immediately starts categorizing it.
Which naturally triggers our defensive shields, I guess. Like, if I hear a statistic about a conflict, my brain immediately tries to figure out whose side the statistic supports or what the political context is.
Precisely. Numbers make people defensive. Data initiates an argument. But if your mission is to rebuild a fractured social fabric and process decades of collective trauma, you need a language that bypasses those rational political defenses entirely.
And poetry does that?
Poetry does this by manipulating pace and rhythm. When you read a poem about an empty chair at a family dinner table, you aren't analyzing a casualty metric. The structure of the poem forces you to slow down, to adopt the author's breathing pattern, and to sit with the emotion.
Wow. So it sneaks past the barricades we build in our minds and appeals purely to human empathy.
Yes. And what makes Bermudez's work so effective here is that he strips away all political affiliation.
Right. The sources are very clear on that. We want to be impartial here, too. The sources show he isn't championing a left-wing or right-wing cause.
Not at all. He's weaponizing poetry to defend the basic human right to exist in peace. By refusing to play the partisan game, he creates a masterclass in universal connection.
That nonpartisan stance really is the strategic bridge. It is the exact mechanism that allows a poem written by a Colombian Montanero to resonate perfectly with a war veteran in El Salvador or a migrant worker in New York.
Because the visceral pain of losing a loved one has no political party.
Exactly. But, you know, words eventually fade if they aren't anchored in physical space. Memory can't just live in a notebook or be spoken into a microphone.
It needs physical presence.
Yeah. If Bermudez gave the region its voice, Shira Duque built the walls to protect that voice. And that brings us to the visual artwork in our archive, specifically Duque's book, Trasteo.
Duque captures the architecture of memory. He provides the visual barricade against forgetting.
The sources detail these incredibly intricate watercolors Duque painted of heritage sites in the Valle del Cauca. He documents places like the Basilica in Sevilla and the La Merced architectural complex.
And these aren't just quick sketches either. They are deeply textured, atmospheric pieces.
Yeah, there is a very deliberate visual tension engineered into his work. Take his painting of La Merced, for example.
Oh, that piece is striking.
In the foreground, you have this delicate, beautiful, ancestral colonial church. But right behind it, looming over the frame and totally dwarfing the church, are these massive, cold, monolithic, modern buildings.
It visually represents what happens when a society is forced to constantly pave over its past just to survive the economic realities of the present.
It's the classic Latin American struggle painted on a single canvas. the constant grinding battle between ancestral identity and the ruthless concrete demands of modern progress.
It really is.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate for a second here. We are talking about a region that was experiencing a very real, very bloody armed conflict in the countryside.
Sure.
Isn't painting pretty watercolors of old colonial churches while the province is burning just a form of, well, romantic escapism? Doesn't it feel like a comfortable, nostalgic retreat for the artist to avoid dealing with the grim reality outside his door?
I get why you'd ask that. It's a common critique of art that looks backward. But the source texts reveal a much more aggressive intent.
Aggressive? How so?
You have to understand the specific tactics of modern conflict. Violent factions use cultural erasure as a literal weapon of war. When an armed group takes over a territory, controlling the roads isn't enough.
Right, they want total control.
Exactly. So they destroy the local landmarks, mm-hmm. they silence the community leaders, they intentionally dismantle the shared history to impose terror and a new order.
Ah, so they wipe the cultural slate clean so they can write their own narrative over the town?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, in that environment, preserving cultural memory is a fierce, active political stance.
It's not passive at all.
No. Painting a historical side of your community isn't nostalgia. It's an ethical barricade. It is a refusal to surrender your symbolic territory to the aggressors. The artist is effectively saying, this is the physical proof of who we are, and you cannot erase us.
Memory as an active line of defense. That entirely shifts the perspective on a simple watercolor. And Duke doesn't just defend local territory either. He makes this massive, unexpected conceptual leap that completely caught me off guard in the sources.
You're talking about the Eastern influence.
It is the wildest twist in the archive. We go from looking at watercolors of Colombian colonial churches to these massive, traumatic acrylic paintings exploring Eastern Vedic spirituality.
Specifically the ISK Khan movement, which brought Hare Krishna philosophy to Latin America.
Right. Duke paints towering portraits of figures like Prabhupada and this huge dramatic piece called Partasarathi.
Partasarathi is a visually striking image. It depicts a grand war chariot being pulled forward by powerful white horses.
It's an amazing visual, but I have to ask, how on earth does ancient Indian Vedic art fit into a deep dive about Colombian social conflict and local memory? It feels like we just jumped to a completely different planet.
It makes perfect sense when you look at the fallout of a fractured society.
Okay, walk me through that.
When violence tears a community apart for decades, the local institutions, the local government, the traditional churches, the justice system, often prove to be entirely insufficient.
Or worse, they are revealed to be compromised and hypocritical.
Exactly. The structures you relied on fail you. And when those structures collapse, an artist still needs an ethical anchor. They have to look elsewhere for a framework that hasn't been corrupted by the local conflict.
So they look outward.
Yes. In Eastern Vedic tradition, the chariot in that painting is a profound metaphor. It represents the human senses, which are wild, powerful, and easily distracted, needing to be guided by a higher disciplined intelligence.
Ah, so the war chariot isn't about physical combat at all. It's an internal metaphor.
Duke is proposing that amidst all the external chaos, the gunfire, the political corruption, the real war is an internal ethical battle.
That true, lasting peace doesn't start with a signed treaty between factions, but with inner spiritual discipline.
Right. It's about conquering the chaos within yourself first so you can be a stable force in a destabilized world.
And Duke takes this internal ethical battle and packages it for the modern world in a very specific way. Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's dig into the title of his book, Trestio.
Trestio is such a brilliant cultural concept.
For context, in Colombia, trestio literally means moving furniture. It's the sweaty, chaotic, exhausting process of packing up everything you own, deciding what is actually worth keeping, and moving to a new house.
It's an everyday chore, but Duke is elevating it into a massive sociological shift.
A shift that both Bermudez and Duke had to navigate to ensure their work survived. You have these two fundamentally analog men, Bermudez with his AM radio broadcasts and paper news columns, Duke with his oil paints and delicate watercolors.
But they realize that to survive the acceleration of time, they have to pack up their human narratives, their ethics, their collective memory, and undergo a digital trastio.
They have to move their culture into the digital sphere.
Because they refuse to let their region's memory be left behind in the analog dust. The sources outline this adaptation beautifully. Bermudez, the local radio guy, begins writing for global digital portals like Telesur and Volterne.
He even wins honors for digital photography, proving he can capture the friction of reality in pixels just as effectively as he did with words on paper.
and Duke bridges the gap with digital art. There's a piece in the catalog called El Beso the Kiss.
Oh, I loved that one. He takes that iconic, world-famous World War II photograph of the sailor kissing the nurse in Times Square, and he turns it into a digital monument.
Yeah, he layers a modern woman with sunglasses into the frame, observing this historical moment of peace. It's a digital bridge connecting a past victory to present hope.
But, and this is crucial, Duke doesn't blindly embrace this digital transition. He is incredibly wary of what is being lost in the move.
Which brings us to what I think is the most intense, arresting piece in this entire archive. It's a massive acrylic painting from 2019 called Contracultura.
It is a masterpiece of modern anxiety. The visual is totally overwhelming.
It's a lot to take in.
Picture this. You have classic humanist aesthetics, traditional art, representations of human beauty literally colliding at 300 kilometers an hour with pure, unfiltered futurism.
The painting is packed with circuit boards, robotics, references to artificial intelligence, and Bitcoin logos.
And all of it is floating in this liquid, unstable, chaotic world where nothing feels solid.
What is truly eerie about Contracultura is its anticipatory nature. The sources note this was painted in 2019.
Right, years before the massive explosion of generative AI that we're living through right now.
Years before chatbots and AI image generators were integrated into every smartphone, Duke was already diagnosing the inherent danger.
He was asking the crucial question of our era. What happens when we dissolve our material ethical base into algorithms?
How do we preserve peace, memory, and human identity in a world that is increasingly mediated by blockchains and bots?
It's a terrifying prospect. Like, are we just going to upload our entire cultural memory, all our local pain and triumph, to a cold server farm and let an algorithm sort out what matters?
That is the exact fear Contracultura wrestles with. The fear of becoming completely unmoored from the physical human experience. The fear that our trastio into the digital world might cost us our soul.
But thankfully, the archives point out a crucial detail in this painting that prevents it from feeling like total defeat.
The human anchor within the chaos.
Right. Alongside all this heavy, cold tech imagery, the robots and the crypto logos Duke includes a simple, beautiful watercolor of Charlie Chaplin from his classic movie, The Kid.
It's a masterful juxtaposition.
Think about why he chose Chaplin in The Kid. That movie is about an orphan and a tramp creating a family out of nothing but mutual need and compassion.
It represents pure, primitive, undeniable human empathy.
Exactly. It's a reminder to the viewer that no matter how advanced our neural networks become, no matter how fast our processors get, the human need for connection, for comfort, and for healing is the actual main infrastructure of society.
An algorithm can synthesize a million stories of grief in a fraction of a second, but it has no skin in the game. It doesn't bear the physical risk of remembering.
That is the core of it. An algorithm doesn't have a mother. It doesn't feel Montanero pride. It doesn't miss the specific smell of its hometown market.
And because it doesn't bleed, because it doesn't carry the physical scars of a conflict, it cannot truly comprehend the value of peace.
Which means artists, writers, and journalists aren't made obsolete in the AI age.
If anything, their role becomes more vital than ever. They are the final bastion of human resistance. Without them, the digital world is just a massive, empty warehouse of data without context.
So what does this all mean? When we synthesize this entire journey, what we see in the archives of Bermudez and Duke is proof that journalism and art aren't just passive mirrors reflecting society.
No, they are active, fierce guardians of the human condition. It redefines what it means to be well-informed.
Right. Being informed isn't just about watching breaking news alerts or checking macroeconomic data dashboards.
True information reading, the actual pulse of a society, happens in the verses of its poets and the brushstrokes of its painters. They map out the invisible scars, the quiet hopes, and the local memories that Google Maps entirely ignores.
The map of our invisible scars. I love that. And that brings it right back to you as we wrap up this deep dive. We are all, right now, in the middle of our own massive technological trastio.
We're all packing up.
We are. We're packing up our analog lives and migrating into a heavily automated, AI-driven future. The sources asked us to think about what personal monuments from our local lives we would pack for this move. But I want to take that a step further into this new AI reality we find ourselves in.
That's a vital question.
Think about the personal monuments of your own life. The specific stories of your grandparents, the exact texture of your childhood neighborhood, your core ethical beliefs. As you pack your life into this new digital reality, consider this. If artificial intelligence eventually learns to perfectly replicate the style of a heartfelt poem or generate a beautiful, flawless watercolor of your hometown in a matter of seconds, will the true value of art in the future rely entirely on the provable, messy human struggle behind it? If flawless creation costs absolutely nothing for a machine, will our human imperfections, our physical risks, and our literal scars become the most valuable currency we have left? Something to think about. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you. We'll see you next time.